Hello, William.
Hey, Ryan.
How you doing?
Yeah, really good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. I'm very excited for today's episode.
I know. It's been one that we've been talking about for a while. It's been long anticipated.
I'm so excited. We might just dive in rather than skip the preamble.
Yeah, no, I'm more than happy to dive right in. I imagine we'll be able to talk about things quite a lot, so there'll be plenty of stuff to go through.
Yeah, well, what is it then? Well, introduce it.
Flat Earth. Okay, so I'm sure... people who genuinely are flat earthers will have lots of problems with this definition, but flat earth is basically the school of thought that the world being a globe is a lie. The world is in fact flat. You know, that it has sort of edges. Very often, so the different flat earthers model it differently, but very often there's a wall of ice around the outside. So, you know, people might say, well, what stops the sea falling off the flat earth? But there's a sort of a wall of ice around it, which constrains the world. And yeah, you know, obviously there's lots of things that spiral off from that, but that's the main premise.
A wall of ice.
A wall of ice.
The ones from Game of Thrones?
So it's interesting. I don't know which precedes the other, because obviously flat earth is relatively new. Maybe they got a bit of inspiration. I guess it makes sense because, like, we know that if you go super up or super down, it gets icy, right? So, you know, it wouldn't make sense if they said there's a wall of jungle, because that is more difficult to sort of prove, I guess. If you know, using prove in the loosest sense.
So if the Earth is flat, that implies there's a center for the Earth, presumably.
Yes, I think so.
If it's a flat disk, then presumably there is a middle of the Earth somewhere.
I think the middle is the North Pole, and then everything sort of, if you imagine a globe, which is a very helpful way to imagine the world, and then sort of from the bottom you sort of unpeel it upwards, and then that gives you your flatness.
Right. So the South Pole, in kind of air quotes, is the outer edge.
Could be our ice wall.
Right. Okay, interesting. So that is how they explain that. For listeners, you can probably tell Will and I are wrestling with this idea.
Yeah,
essentially, that's the way they explain the magnetic kind of fields of the Earth, which is that we'll always point to the north is always at the center of the Earth.
Well, I think that the problem with, you know, it's very easy to sort of say, well, it's not round, it's flat. But the problem is that actually has a lot of implications, right? You know, I saw a video of Brian Cox talking about how gravity works. And basically, the way that gravity works wouldn't work in a celestial body of that shape. It wouldn't work like it does in the real world. And so actually, if you're very diehard flat Earth, you have to also not believe in the theory of gravity in the way that it's proposed at the moment. You know, you can still believe that things fall when you drop them, but you might believe, for example, that there's some kind of magnet underneath the disc that brings everything down. Well, you know, I don't know exactly what they say for it, but there are what sounds like a pretty simple change actually become, you know, pretty much everything changes when you change what the world is like, right?
Yeah. It's a very interesting idea, isn't it? Because on the face of it, it's not absurd, is it? Like, I mean, as a casual observer, 100 years ago, it wouldn't have been absurd to suggest the Earth is flat. Like, yes, we have evidence to show actually even the Greeks knew it wasn't flat.
Yeah.
But it's the fact that once you believe that as a fact, then you have to try and explain the world around you.
Yeah.
And what we use to explain the world around us are, you know, theories of physics and maths, which have been developed over centuries. And therefore, you have to almost come up with an increasingly contorted branch of pseudoscience to try and explain increasingly stranger things. I mean, stuff that we take relatively for granted, like tides, for instance. How would that work? Or ocean currents or the Coriolis effect? I mean, we could just go on and on.
Yeah, it is interesting because when you see flat earthers talk about it and the way that they approach it, they see themselves, obviously, as scientists, basically. They see themselves as people who are using the information that they perceive to make ideas and theories, and then they try and test it, which is ultimately what science mm-hmm. is. But of course, there's a, like you say, because you don't see just at standing level that the world is round, yeah. there's that inherent distrust of other people telling you that it is, and that, you know,
yeah.
And all that information that then builds up on that, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. So essentially, there's obviously a level of, there was a really good documentary I watched on Netflix called Behind the Curve.
I think I've seen it as well, yeah.
Yeah. And in it, they talk about exactly what you just said, which is actually every flat earther, they're not an idiot, as you know, sometimes we'd like to think, but they were at one point, had the potential to be a very good scientist. It's just they went slightly wayward.
Yeah.
Because essentially the way science works is we say, why does this happen?
Mm.
Or how does this happen? Those are generally the two main questions science asks, how and why. And we don't, and when you ask those questions, you genuinely have no idea what the answer is.
And you're also meant to approach it with a lot of skepticism, right?
Yeah. And you have an open mind, and then you run experiments which then narrow down the field of possibilities, and you keep running more and more refined, elaborate experiments until you get to an answer which seems to essentially obey some level of theory that you've conjectured. But you know, if some other evidence comes along, then it's reasonable to kind of drop your theory and accept the next one. I mean, that so when they first launched satellites into orbit, they have I told you this?
I don't think so.
No. So when they first launched satellites, GPS satellites, they found that the GPS was always about 20 to 40 meters off. Now, 20 to 40 meters off isn't too bad, right?
Yeah.
Like, considering it's coming from 20 kilometers above in space, like that's
and
pretty good.
That must have been like sort of 70 years ago as well. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I couldn't do that, right? But what they were doing was the satellites were configured using Newtonian mechanics rather than general relativistic mechanics. So as soon as they kind of changed the parameters and used Einstein's theorems instead of Newton's, the satellites miraculously started working perfectly.
And is that just because of the distance that they were out?
Exactly, yeah. So Newtonian mechanics works really well with everything that we see, apples falling from trees, balls bouncing away. Sure. But it starts to break down when you get to a very, very large scale.
Okay.
Now, Einstein was very complimentary of Newton. He said, you know, I'm able to do my work because of the work he did. And this is exactly the same progress that, you know, in theory, we should start seeing in science, right? But what we find with not just flat earthers, but generally a lot of other kind of skeptical people, and like that those who are quite distrusting, is they have they kind of do things in a different order. So instead of doing an experiment and then letting that experiment guide them to the answer, they think they know what the answer is, and then they run increasingly elaborate experiments to try and prove that theory, which is the opposite of what it should be.
And you know, it's the whole sort of null hypothesis idea that actually when you run an experiment, you say nothing's going to happen, or you anticipate nothing is going to happen until you see it happen, and then you can say, okay, something happens, so then we can make a theory based on it. So, you know, like you say, cutting out all other possible options until you're left with one rather than trying to affirm one.
Yeah, you're just like being Sherlock Holmes, essentially, aren't you? You just eliminate the probable, so the impossible remains, and that's the correct thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think obviously, so there's the wider discussion of why do people believe in conspiracy theories. Obviously, this is one conspiracy theory. But there's a lot out there, right? People believe lots and lots of different things. People believe, you know, in sort of lizard people. People believe that the moon landing didn't happen. Actually, lots of flat earthers don't believe that we've been to the moon. That, you know,
yeah, they tend to kind of
very often interact.
Yeah.
And I think that makes sense because, you know, as soon as you have a general distrust of sort of understanding scientific authority overall, it makes sense that that's going to transfer elsewhere, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'd be interesting to know what percentage of flat earthers also don't believe in vaccines. My guess would be it'd be quite high.
Potentially high, yeah. And also, if you sort of confront them with that, well, why do you, if they do believe in vaccines, why do you believe this line of science but not this line of science? You know, because that's a bit of a discrepancy there, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, to be clear, we're all about advocating for scientific literacy and being skeptical and being questioning.
Yeah.
But not at the expense of essentially being ignorant to overwhelming evidence. I mean, the analogy I sometimes use is, imagine you've got Little Red Riding Hood on the edge of a forest.
Oh, Rohan, I've lost your sound. I don't know if that's...
So the analogy I often use is, imagine you've got Little Red Riding Hood on the edge of a forest. And Little Red Riding Hood doesn't believe that the big bad wolf exists. All she wants to do is go see her grandma in the middle of the forest. And there's a sign, as she's walking into the forest, she starts seeing signs saying, "Don't go here, there's a big bad wolf waiting for you up ahead. Turn left instead, where you'll be able to see your grandma." And she keeps ignoring those signs and eventually goes into the middle of the forest. And that's essentially what flat earthers / skeptics are doing, is that they're ignoring all the signs and just using the evidence that they want to use in order to get to their destination.
Yeah, and you know, that's not just conjecture from us. You do see that. So at the end of the documentary, they run that experiment with lasers to try and prove that, you know, the Earth isn't curving and it is flat. You know, the idea is, if you point a laser along a flat surface, it will get sort of picked up at the same height that it was shot off at. And they do this right at the end of the documentary, and they don't find what they're expecting to find, right?
Yep.
They actually find that the sort of laser is higher than they're, you know, they pick it up higher than they're expecting, and that's about as high as you'd expect if the Earth was curved. But, you know, the response isn't, okay, these are the experimental findings, we then need to reject our hypothesis. The response is, well, something was wrong with the test. You know, something along those lines. And it, you know, sometimes tests aren't good, right? You do have, you know, you read scientific papers and you think, actually, this isn't a well-controlled test. You've done something wrong here, and what you think you're finding, you haven't found. But I think if you do, that's a relatively robust test, I would have thought. You know, I don't know too much about lasers and physics, but it makes sense to me as a test of what they're trying to test. And to just sort of reject it because it doesn't give you the result you're expecting is where their scientificness runs out, right?
Yeah,
they're doing really well up until that point, and you know, it's a perfectly valid avenue of scientific exploration, even though you might say it's not necessary. But at that point, that's where they lose their, I think, their credentials.
Yeah, so essentially, they're just essentially it's the way of ignoring evidence that doesn't fit with your ideas. Yeah. That seems to be the major issue.
Yeah, and it's tough, right? Because you might have any scientist might have built their whole career on one theory, on one idea. They might run a number of tests to start with, you know, spend 10 years and it's looking really positive and they think this theory works and they think it's going to, you know, change understanding. And then they, you know, do the next test and it doesn't work. And, you know, it could be that your whole life's work was sort of misinformed for whatever reason, but you can't then just, if you do multiple tests and it actually isn't right, you can't just sort of carry on thinking that it is, you know, what you thought it was originally. Pretty gutting, but that's just how it is.
Yeah. And I guess there's a lot to be said about having such unshakable faith that you're right compared to everyone else, especially when often, I mean, I don't know any theoretical physicists or astronomers who are flat earthers. I just don't know any, right? That's likely because it's incompatible with physics. But for then people to think that they know better than someone who studied in their field for decades,
yeah,
I think that's quite a I find that a very strange idea that I can kind of think that I know better than someone else.
But it's interesting that you're sort of saying, you know, it makes sense that it would be incompatible to be a physicist and a flat earther. But then you have, you know, nurses who don't want, who are anti-vax. And you sort of think, well, you know, it's, you know, not a perfect analogy, but I think you do have people that spend their life living with incompatible views, and they just ignore the fact that their views are incompatible, perhaps, because it's easier to.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and I know a few doctors who don't actually believe in cells, for instance. I mean, I don't understand how that's possible. Wow. But they just kind of get on with it.
They don't believe in cells.
They don't believe in cells.
Because presumably is this a big movement or a small movement in the medical
community? I think it's like a two-person movement.
Okay. That's interesting. I mean, again, you know, it's fine to question things. But I think when the evidence mounts up,
yeah, you just have to be able to accept mistakes. I just wonder, of course, you know, there's probably a phenomenon where you're so entrenched in your position that kind of conceding would almost like remove a large aspect of your identity.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think the people who, you know, there are a couple celebrities now in the flat earth world. And I think even if they change their mind or they realize that they were wrong, I think at that point you're so far gone. You know, if you say, "Oh, actually, guys, sorry, I was wrong," you can't really do that because you've just created like a cult following around you. So there's that pressure to keep going, and that probably has some impact on why people who are conspiratorial sort of become even more conspiratorial as they go. They're sort of egged on by their followers.
Yeah, it's like a big bubble effect, isn't it? Or like a founder's effect where you're just hanging out.
Yeah.
And it's just reinforcing your own views.
Yeah, definitely.
An echo chamber, there we go.
Echo chamber, good. And I think one of the things that builds on the whole, you know, believing that you know better than an expert is with something like Flat Earth, the number of people that would need to be lying about the world being round is just like astronomical. Right, there's so many people. It's not like only, you know, Donald Trump knows whether or not the world is round or not. There would be so many scientists, officials, politicians who are involved in that kind of information who would have to all be basically lying. That it just
it's
makes
also what it's just why as well, right?
Like, yeah,
why would they lie? Like, I understand why people would lie about landing on the moon. Like, obviously, there's like national pride and the impact of it. But why would the whole world lie about the Earth being flat? That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I don't know. And I mean, they've probably thought out a few different reasons why they might. I mean, in one of the videos that I watched, one of the flat earthers was saying something along the lines of the first rule of sort of being in power is don't let them know that there's something greater than you, right? So I guess the theory is by saying that the world is a globe, we're not made aware that there are sort of greater powers at play. But I don't really think that makes sense. You know, there's just as likely to be greater powers at play if the world is flat, right? It doesn't really change anything.
No. Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of inconsistencies throughout, right? I mean, one of them, I mean, based on what you just said, is right. If the Earth is a disc surrounded by a big wall of ice, presumably this ice wall is not infinitely tall. And therefore, it's possible to either scale it or even more easily just fly over it.
Yeah.
In which case, it would stand to reason that once you fly past this sheet of ice, you're in space.
Or and also gives the possibility to go underneath, right?
Oh, to the other side.
Yeah.
So is there like another Earth on the other side?
Maybe that's what they're keeping from us. I suppose you could fit that into your theory. There's something very important on the other side that they don't want us to know about.
Literally the upside down.
The upside down. I don't want to know about the upside down. It can stay where it is.
But yeah. You know, as far as given how much movement this kind of belief seems to be getting now, it wouldn't be that difficult to charter a plane and just tell it to fly for 20 hours.
Yeah.
And or 24 hours, and eventually, well, it should probably be a bit longer, or 48 hours, you'd probably end up right back where you started.
But given what we've said about the fact that if you were right at the top and you actually thought, I don't think this is legit, but I have to keep going because this is what my life is now, there would be a motivation for you to not actually run experiments that prove or disprove it. If you're the head honcho and someone says to you, look, I've got a great idea, we'll charter a plane, we'll fly around the world, but we won't, right? Because it was flat and we'll prove that it's flat. You might be sat there thinking, crap, if they do this, it's going to work out that it's round.
Then you find an increasingly elaborate excuse to...
Yeah, and you're like, oh, well, you can't trust planes. Planes will trick you.
Yeah, the pilot will just go around in a circle. Don't trust them.
But you're right. That's a really good point. Why haven't they done that? Because that would seem the most obvious solution.
Yeah, I mean, because I've seen some of the models. I don't know if you've seen them. Because obviously with the current Copernican like model of the solar system, it's pretty straightforward, right? Like, there's several planets all rotate around the Earth.
Yeah,
but the flat earthers have created their own models where there's sun and moon kind of sitting essentially in parallel and going around the disk above the Earth, which kind of explain day and night.
Yeah.
But they don't really explain time zones either, which is a strange thing.
Yeah. Again, you know, as soon as you change one thing, that one thing about the world, there are all these extra things that suddenly you need to make theories for. And it's probably just there's not enough flat earthers to come up with theories quick enough to explain everything.
There's a lot of work, isn't it?
Yeah, huge. You have to re-explain everything. Nightmare.
But I think the most discordant thing that I find with this entire theory is that if you ask a flat earther about Mars or Jupiter, you say, like, what do you think about them? You know, why are ellipses? Why do we get like crescentic total eclipses, for example? They say that actually the moon, Mars, sun, they're all round.
Yeah.
But the Earth is flat.
The Earth is flat. It's strange, isn't it?
I think that's the strangest thing that I find about it. Like, there's something like inherently unique about the Earth, which instead of making it form into a globe, it forms into a disc.
But it's quite an egocentric world, a view of the world, right? And it's how they viewed things a couple thousand years ago. You know, we are the center of the universe. The sun goes around us. The moon goes around us. And that's because that's sort of how it looks. But actually, the sort of depressing thing is, actually, the world isn't that special. It's just a random place in an enormous, you know, mass of other random places. And it's special because it's, you know, nicely Goldilocks zoned. But aside from that, it's not, you know, the first person, you know, it's not the main character of this story necessarily, the story of the universe. Whereas the flat Earth takes it back to that, doesn't it? Because then, it says the moon is going around us, the sun is going around us. We're the only flat entity in the entire universe. So I guess it might give you a sense of being special and being unique, which is nice.
Yeah. But there has to be some reason why the Earth is flat, right? Like physically, like there has to be some mechanism that explains why. Because it just doesn't happen in nature. Like, gravity just doesn't work in those dimensions.
But so with the whole other planets are spheres, do they have to be spheres? Or could they just be flat disks on their side?
Well, no, because that's what I thought. But then they've gone on record and saying, actually, Mars is round and et cetera, et cetera.
They shot themselves in the foot doing that. They should have on the side.
At least then you could come up with some kind of weird gravitational theory that contorts large bodies into discs rather than globes. But
yeah,
for it to explain like globes and discs is a big, it's a very twisted gravity.
It is. And I think, you know, I would like to watch them explain how they understand gravity working, because I think that would just be quite interesting to see what they've made of it. That is a big inconsistency, and I think you're right saying it's probably one of the biggest the strangest things about it. And there are lots of strange things about it, but that's a pretty strange thing.
Yeah.
To do with it. But yeah, so they all, from the things that I've seen, none of them believe that we've been to space. They believe that the rockets get sent up, but then they're just sort of discarded. And, you know, part of me thinks, like, even if there was this amazing secret thing that they're keeping hidden, it must be so expensive to spend, you know, billions and billions of pounds. Surely it's not worth that much to go through this whole charade of keeping that semblance, right? What could be over there?
The upside down, yeah.
The upside down, yeah. No, it's very strange.
I almost wanted to be real. Just to see
what Earth being flat.
Yeah, I think it'd be quite like a... Just because I'd like want to go and take a plane to the edge of space, right? That'd be a really easy way to get into space, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Like, our space woes of, like, transporting materials to, like, Mars would be so easy.
So handy,
Elon Musk would be out of a job.
But I guess there must be... There must be someone with enough of a computer science background who would be able to sort of model. I'd be surprised if they don't already have models of the solar system, which are all sort of rules of physics applied, right? You know, you have games where they apply rules of physics to things. So I'm sure they've got a model of it. It would be very interesting to see if they do have that. What happens to the model if you do just turn it into a disc?
Oh, if you turn the Earth into a disk.
If you turn the Earth into a disk in this model, but say all the current sort of rules of physics and equations still apply, it'd be interesting to see what happens.
The Earth would probably turn into a globe every
time. You just see it sort of expand outwards. I mean, because obviously their response would be, well, that's because these rules of physics that we've been given are lies to make us think that it's a globe. But it'd still be interesting to see how different things would behave.
Yeah, it'd be, it's obviously well and good, you know, you and I, because we were broadly very much aligned on this. But it'd be interesting to speak to someone who is a flat earther, get their view. So, you know, if anyone's listening, please do drop us an email.
I do. So, I would be interested in that conversation, but I do worry, because obviously when people are very, very sure of one thing, it's quite difficult to speak with them about it, because ultimately if you question it, it's not like a discussion where you're just exploring ideas. If you question it, you are intrinsically questioning them and their personal identity. It would be interesting to see how that discussion goes. There probably are. I think there are. There must be debates online between flat earthers and scientists. Mm. But I'd be surprised if they get anywhere, to be honest. I imagine it's just one side saying one thing and the other side saying, no, it's this, and then just that back and forth for half an hour.
Yeah, and I think the other problem is the people who mediate these debates seem to take a very strange approach to them, which just tends to be everything's lively and jovial and that both sides are worth listening to. I mean, not that they aren't, but it tends to be actually both sides can be correct.
Yeah.
And they often don't get individuals to kind of commit. So because they're generally not scientifically literate, right? Like they're journalists.
Some
journalists are scientifically literate, but they don't, in my experience, they're not the ones who are kind of mediating these or chairing these discussions.
Yeah,
I think that doesn't help. It's the same with like climate scientists, right? Because they always have like one climate scientist and one like person who doesn't believe in climate change.
Yeah.
Whereas in reality, probably be like if you were to do like proportionately, be like 99 versus 1 or something.
Yeah, definitely. But again, you know, climate change is an interesting one. You know, it's a field whereby, again, I think there's merit in the pursuit of saying, well, you know, there's lots of things pointing towards climate change, but are we sure that it is? And I think that's a fine pursuit to say, you know, it's fine to just say, are we sure? But I think, you know, what happens is these people, again, like the flat earthers, they often just sort of disregard evidence rather than evaluating it and taking it in, which I think, you know, discredits what they're saying. You know, I think there's lots of ways to evaluate and take into account evidence and still have a different opinion at the end of it and still sort of draw a slightly different conclusion. But when you ignore it, it's disappointing.
Yeah, it'd be, I suppose, the equivalent of the climate change analogy to the flat earther would be something like an individual saying that actually climate change isn't man-made. It's caused by an overpopulation of squirrels.
Yeah.
And that we need to exterminate them immediately.
And then
coming up with increasingly.
Yeah.
You know, explaining why squirrels cause climate change.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's not a particularly credible argument. And I think the flat earth argument isn't very credible. But equally, you know, that there are sort of, I've seen climate change deniers who will say that actually when you look at sort of solar activity, you know, I don't really know much about this, but I've seen them say, you know, solar flare activity, that actually does help explain quite a lot of the data that we've found. Now, that in itself isn't a ridiculous thing to say, I don't think. I don't think it means that climate change doesn't exist. You know, it just means that as with something which is so multivariate as the entire planet's atmosphere, they're saying there are probably more things at play here. Whereas I don't think the flat earthers are saying there's more to this than we think. They're saying absolutely everything that we think is wrong, and actually it's this. And I think I don't think they're super subtle differences, but they make a big difference, right?
I suppose it's probably worth talking about why people who potentially have the ability to be very good scientists end up drifting down this path.
Yeah.
And I think in that documentary, there was a very clever scientist who was asked the question, well, why don't you go and disprove them vehemently? Why don't you talk sense into them? And he said, look, nowadays, there's just so many people who believe strongly in something that they don't have evidence for. And if we were to try and educate every single person why they're wrong, then we wouldn't actually be able to do any science.
Yeah.
I suppose the key word there is believe, right? Like, how can you believe something? Like, it has to be founded in some evidence.
Well, does it? You know, I think ultimately there are lots of things that we believe without necessarily seeing the evidence ourselves. You know, and you can look at faith as a really good example. You know, there's no, the whole point of faith is that there's no evidence, right? But you believe it anyway. Mm. And, you know, but there are still analogies. To a degree, you and I have a belief in the established science, right? I haven't read much of any of Newton's work. I briefly read, you know, some very strange old Greek work, but like ultimately the very sort of core early science, we haven't actually read ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, modern science, I'm sure you've read lots of scientific papers that have been released in the last 50, 100 years.
Or maybe not read Newton's Principia then.
I haven't. It's on the reading list. I didn't get it for Christmas this year, sadly. But yeah, you know, it's a lot of that is something that we do believe in without having necessarily seen the evidence ourselves. But I have a trust that someone else who is very qualified to see it and evaluate it has done so and has, you know, made the right conclusion. You have to trust.
And then you've done it in good faith, right? Because, I mean, if we think about, if I asked you how your computer works, like on a mechanistic level, you'd probably struggle. I mean,
I would struggle, yeah.
right? But we're both using one right now.
Yeah.
And we have for a serious part of our lives. Yet the same argument seems to break down when it comes to vaccines, for instance. People say, well, I don't understand how it works, therefore it can't be good.
They'll have
a tweet about that on their phone, for instance, which they have no clue how it works.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I'm sure that there's lots of things that flat earthers will do without questioning it at all. You know, using a computer, getting into a car. These are all things.
Using GPS.
Using GPS. I'm sure they use Google Maps all the time to get where they want to be.
Yeah,
but
that is built on general.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting because you know we said earlier that as soon as you change this one thing, suddenly everything changes. But I suppose everything changes until it's inconvenient for you. At which point, you know, you're fine using a TV, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Why do you think it is? Is some people, you know, have the potential to be really good scientists, kind of end up drifting into this line and then become increasingly entrenched in this form.
So I think there are a couple of things. I read a book about sort of conspiracy theorists a few years ago. It's quite interesting. I think there are two main things. So the first thing is we are inherently good at spotting patterns. Humans are really good at detecting patterns, so good that we will detect it in noise, right? So good that we'll start thinking that, if you toss a coin three times in a row and you get heads three times in a row, you start thinking, this coin seems a bit dodgy, even though probabilistically that's absolutely fine and can happen. You sort of notice these patterns, even though it's just part of a normal probability distribution. And so what happens, sort of broadly speaking, for conspiracy theorists is they see different bits of information dotted around and they start to see patterns in it where patterns don't exist. So, for example, you know, 9/11 being an inside job is a good example. You know, they'll often, people who believe in that will often cite lots of different things, which ultimately on their own aren't really that meaningful. And actually, you know, probably are just the strangeness of life, right? Life is a bit strange, things like that. And so you notice these patterns and you start to think, oh, something's a bit strange there. And then you have your own confirmation bias that as soon as you notice that pattern, you're going to notice it more and more and more. So as soon as you start thinking, I can't see the horizon, maybe the world is flat, you then start thinking, oh, hold on. I was on a plane the other day and it looked kind of flat as well. This is a bit weird. So suddenly all these different things, which are just information, just noise, you initially spot a pattern, which isn't really there. And then you confirm that yourself by selectively looking for it. And again, that's partly why people who do believe in conspiracies, suddenly it transfers to everything. You might start off thinking, well, you know, I'm a little susceptible of 5G towers. You know, I'm not sure about the signals that they're giving off. And then all of a sudden, you know, you think Bill Clinton was a lizard person, and it will snowball basically. So it could happen to anyone.
Yeah. So I suppose one is the confirmation bias, but there's an extra element to it, right? Because if I saw something, I'm trying to think of an example. Like if I saw something that was a bit strange, and let's say I saw that, I don't know, they seem to be more lollipop ladies in Oxford these days. And then I saw a lollipop just lying on the floor the next day. I start thinking, oh, maybe we're hiring more lollipop ladies because there's more accidents happening.
Yeah.
But actually, the next day, if I read an article in the newspaper saying, actually, lollipop ladies, there was a convention on.
Yeah.
And that's it. Then I'd be like, okay, fine, that's it, right? But in my case, I've trusted a relatively independent newspaper.
Yeah.
Instead of...
If there is such a thing.
Yeah. Rather than letting my preconceived ideas kind of spiral. So there is obviously what you said, which is confirmation bias. But I think there's the second... element to it is a lack of trust in established authority.
Yeah. But I suppose in this example, obviously you're responding to the information that you're given, right?
Mm.
So you see lots of lollipop ladies, you think, maybe there's a lollipop lady conspiracy. But then you see articles saying, oh, don't worry, it's just a lollipop convention. But that day you might not have read that paper. You might have instead watched a YouTube video about a lollipop lady killing someone. And then you sort of, you think, oh, well, hold on. This is really strange. So it's, I think you're right. There's definitely a switch in sort of evaluation, but it's also very stimulus driven.
Yeah. And I suppose instead of reading on day three, if I'd kind of formed this idea and then it kept being reinforced by everything I saw, and it didn't go challenged. And a year later, I found that exact newspaper from a year ago and I read that. I'd be like, oh no, that's just a cover up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. you know, you're too far gone for evidence to convince you otherwise.
Obama talks about this a long time ago. So he says, actually, flat earthers do principle, the movement started out in America.
Yeah.
And it seems to be like that's where the center of their world is. and he says, actually, in America, what you've got is there are like essentially left and right. Mm. And they're, because the left read left newspapers and read right newspapers, and the media is very catered towards each of them, probably more than in most countries.
Sure.
We end up where there's increasingly more intense echo chambers where people start believing increasingly more extreme things.
Yeah.
So, and it doesn't have to be political. It could also be about flat earthers, for instance. Mm. In this instance, if I then pointed out to other people, hey, have you seen so many lollipop ladies and kind of created my ideas? It'd be a pretty lame convention.
I can picture the Facebook group now.
Oxford taken over by lollipop.
Yeah. No, but you're right. And also, you know, YouTube, Facebook, social media makes it so much easier than ever before, right? Mm. What could have once been random discontinuous views of one person in one part of the country and another person in another part of the country, they never meet, they never talk about it, it dies with them. Instead, these people are discussing it and it's building, right?
Yeah, and I wonder if this would have ever kicked off without social media, actually, because if I went to my friends or most people on the street in the UK, because the UK are quite sceptical anyway.
Yeah.
I said to them, the earth is flat. The vast majority, at least 80%, would look at me very oddly.
Mm.
Right? And that would probably make me feel quite shameful.
Yeah, that's and enough to not make you want to do it again.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas actually, if all you have to do is kind of write a big blog and then shove it onto Facebook somewhere, and then random people across the world start liking it, sharing it, commenting it, then there's the brain's the signals and the stimuli the brain's getting, they're all positive,
right? Yeah,
negative. And then that makes it much easier as well to kind of get into.
Yeah. And again, you know, with conspiracies, anyone who sort of, if there even was someone who went onto this blog who didn't believe in it and tried to argue against you, there's the very easy out of, well, you're part of the conspiracy, you're trying to make us not believe it.
Mm.
And when you have such a unfalsifiable excuse, it's very difficult to ever get around that, basically. But I'd be surprised if this could come about without social media. I mean, you know, I do think social media gets a bad rap overall, because I do think it achieves a lot of things which wouldn't be possible without it too. But, you know, like you say, in this kind of scenario where things are just polarized and polarized and polarized, the good that it can achieve is really good. You know, you see these enormous fundraisers that people do. What was his name? Captain Tom for the NHS. You know, that never would have happened without social media. He never would have raised that much money. On the other side of the coin, or on the other side of the disc-shaped earth, you've got these kind of less helpful, less beneficial things which develop. So, you know, there's good and bad.
So I guess we're kind of saying it's a threefold thing, right? Like it's confirmation biased, coupled with a lack of trust from established authorities. And then added onto the background of social media and then the ability to create echo chambers more easily.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it'd be really interesting to sort of track a conspiracy theorist as they sort of start to become one. Because obviously it's very difficult, you know, if you sort of picked out the head of the Flat Earth Society and you sort of say to them, well, can you tell us when you started believing? I imagine they probably wouldn't actually have a very good sense of it. But you could probably see from if they were blog posting, you'd actually probably see quite an interesting progression. And that loss of trust is probably not that pronounced at the start. It's probably just a, you know, potentially a healthy skepticism, but it sort of becomes worse and worse as it goes.
And I think probably for the first time in human history, we probably have the ability to do this now.
Right? Yeah.
Especially because obviously people are based in the US, there'll be a lot of like face-to-face conversations, but if someone's based in Zambia, then they're probably not many flat earthers around.
Yeah.
But they will be able to interact with flat earth articles. So I'm sure I wouldn't be surprised if Facebook had a study or a psychology PhD. Maybe you should looking into this idea, right? Because obviously it's a really important thing is how people develop these biases. And then
the only problem is, I think the point at which you're already interacting or potentially producing content. So if we were tracking someone's blog articles about flat earth, your first blog article where you feel confident enough to put a blog out about flat earth, you've already missed a bit of development, right? You're early, but you're not right at the start. You're not at the point where the scales tipped, basically.
But presumably they'd be able to check in to see when they started looking at, like, when was the day zero of flat earth article? When was the first time you liked it or commented on it?
And you could track their like search history. You could see how their behaviors change. Again, you know, algorithms don't help that because, of course, as soon as you look at one thing, it then feeds you three more of it, right?
Yeah, of course.
But you know, you still have the capacity to watch one thing and then say, "I'm going to watch something else now." I also think an interesting thing that I think happens is I think people are interested in conspiracy theories because they find them sort of entertaining, right? So you know, they sort of see a couple of videos and you think it's interesting that people believe this. But I think the more and more you expose yourself to it, even from like an interest level, it'd be interesting to see how you prevent yourself from starting to believe it, right? Because you're putting yourself in this echo chamber as sort of like an imposter. Right, you're able to preserve yourself while still being subjected to all this. And it'd be interesting to see if a computer which was looking at conspiracy theorists' online behaviors could detect between the two. And it'd be interesting to see actually how long you can prevent yourself from starting to believe things. Because, you know, just naturally, the more you listen to something, the more you're likely to believe it and subscribe to it. It's a little bit inevitable, I'd have thought.
Yeah.
Although I suppose actually the more you could, you know, you have people who debate other people about topics, and I suppose that debate itself will make you solidify your own position. So maybe it doesn't, maybe it helps you, maybe you can solidify it. I don't know.
Yeah, just on the topic of that, when you say debate, that always kind of gets, it's like a trigger word in my head.
Yeah.
Because when I hear about debates, it tends to be around topics that aren't open book, like they aren't just like close cases, right? Like there tends to be things like euthanasia or like cloning, things that don't really have a particularly correct answer from your viewpoint and your principles and morality, etc. And what always bugs me is whenever you go into a courtroom, it's never the person who's right that wins. It's the person who can convince certain key stakeholders that their argument is the strongest or best constructed, rather than that they're in the absolute correct, right? And like in some cases, it's obviously very difficult. Like for instance, like cases of most corporate cases or like cases of like, I don't know, like petty theft or something. Like it's always like left to right. But if it's an easy case, if I've always thought that it should be based on facts rather than the strength of how good your lawyer is.
Yeah. So the fact that, like you say, how good your lawyer is determines whether or not you win the case or not is indicative that it's not a perfect system.
Mm.
Right. You know, it is a system which can be abused, and you're right. It's not necessarily the person who was right who wins in the end. Mm. But I suppose it's so, in those scenarios, it's so difficult to determine who is right that, or it must be so difficult to determine that who is right, that the system that they've got in place is sort of the best, next best thing.
Yeah.
You know,
I guess if we apply that in if there was ever a courtroom for flat earthers.
Yeah.
I wouldn't sleep comfortably.
Yeah.
Because there's no 100% guarantee, right, that it would be conclusively proven and struck out.
Yeah, and you know, you rely on trusting 12 members of the general public to make a good decision.
Yeah, some of which may be flat earthers in themselves.
Well, yeah, here's the problem. But I think, actually, to an individual, a flat earther could present a really charismatic and persuasive case. I have no doubt. I'm sure they could present things the way they want to. But, you know, you can present anything in a persuasive way. I remember, I don't know why I have a picture of this, but at some point, maybe it was one of the presentations you did, but there's sort of these graphs of correlations that, you know, there's this huge database of correlations of things which just categorically are not correlated. You know, it could be like size of sea snake in the Indian Ocean and sort of middle class BMI, but it's just that these correlations are all over the place and they exist. But you you could still use data to convince someone of something, even if it's not really great.
Yeah, and I think there was a practice when I was a junior doctor with some F1 F2 colleagues. And they were essentially set some fairly boring research projects.
Mm.
And essentially what it was you have a spreadsheet, you have like 50, 100 patients that you're collecting data on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's literally about 30 columns of data that you have to fill in. Now, that's obviously a very boring exercise. And ideally, once you've done all that work, you want something to be able to show for it.
Right? Yeah.
Now, if you follow that scientific principle, you should have a null hypothesis going into it and then say, right, this is what I think, or there is a link, or this is my theory.
Mm.
And then you just analyze those key pieces of data that shows up. But what was happening in practice, I saw this all the time, was that people were just running stats to see which of those 24, 30 columns there was a correlation between. And then, you know, it would get surprisingly far into the peer review process with some of these things.
Just trying to
Yeah, and, you know, obviously it's a great way of kind of getting a publication, but it's not, as you said, it's a correlation rather than causation. So if you run enough analyses on enough numbers, you will find a pattern.
Yeah.
That's just unavoidable.
Again, it's that sort of detecting a pattern in noise, right? Sometimes noise will align up really nicely, but it's still noise. And I guess the more analyses, well, that's why often with, when you have like multi-analysis of variants, you have to have corrections if you're analyzing loads of things at the same time, because, you know, the stats whizzes a few years ago worked out that it was less reliable if you're just analyzing absolutely everything at the same time. Anyway,
yes.
I think there's probably, I don't know if there's anything about flat earth, I mean there's probably lots about flat earth that we've missed, but I think we sort of covered the main concepts. Anything else that you wanted to add on it?
I guess it's probably, as a closing thing, it'd probably be worth just talking a little bit about what is the one thing that you would, you know, if you were speaking to Flat Earther now, what is the clearest thing you would say to them or ask them to explain in order to give credence to their theory? So for me, I think I've already said, like, my biggest thing is the fact that Mars and other like planets are meant to be globes rather than discs. I think that's probably the one I'd go for. The other thing I thought of was, in a lunar eclipse, the shadow that the Earth projects onto the moon isn't a disc. It's actually a crescent.
Right.
I think that'd be very difficult to explain.
Yeah.
And I think they have tried. They've said that if the Earth is aligned correctly, then the disc would be
creating a crescent. It would.
But that creates the same problems.
Yeah. I would be quite interested to know what they believe is being hidden from us. Because that, you know, ultimately the whole point of the lie is that it must be a lie for some reason, right? So I'd be interested to know what is on the other side. Yeah, I mean, there's so many things, right? There's so many things that don't quite make sense. We didn't even talk about Hollow Earth, which is a shame. Maybe I'll bring that up another time.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, yeah, that's a nice way of wrapping things up.
Yeah. Have you got a fact for this week?
Yeah. So I was having a think about my hobbies of late when I was in med school.
Okay.
And I really got into solving Rubik's Cubes.
Okay.
When I was there. And I managed to get my time down to under 2 minutes, which, you know, I was pretty proud of.
It's pretty quick, yeah.
But the whole speed cubing thing is like an entire kind of, it has its own like fan base.
I've seen them doing it really whilst juggling. It's very impressive.
Yeah, so the speed record for doing it is, I think, 6 or 7 seconds. But actually, there's also the ability to do it. There's various categories of Rubik's Cube, speed cubing, as they call it. And one of the categories is blindfolded and one-handed.
Right.
And you may think, well, that's just absurd, right?
But that's absurd.
The record for that is less than 20 seconds. In fact, I think it was like 14 seconds or so last time I checked.
That's nuts.
It is nuts. But what I think is even crazier is someone actually went to the trouble of creating a robot that could solve a Rubik's Cube. And the record for that is less than 1 second.
As in, the robot twists?
Yeah.
Less than a second?
Yeah. But it's not the fact that they created a machine that solves in less than 1 second. I don't think that'd be absurdly difficult nowadays. But it's the fact that someone actually bothers to create a machine to solve a Rubik's Cube, which I still find quite strange.
I don't know if that robot has many transferable skills. That is 6 seconds. You know, sometimes I struggle to turn a page in 6 seconds if it gets sticky. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that guy should like launch his own masterclass on how to do quick things.
It's interesting that Rubik's Cubes have gathered such an obsession, right?
They have, and you know, it's just based on what you said, right? Like, the transferable skills are actually very, very limited. Like, sometimes I wonder about this because if you we'll probably save this for another episode, but if you're hyper specialized in something, that's actually not that doesn't often show great level of breadth or breadth of kind of awareness and knowledge, right?
Yeah,
like, it's the same as if someone's a chess grandmaster. Like, I'm sure they know all the 30, 40 openings off by heart, but they're not going to do particularly well if you put them in front of a normal video game, for instance.
Yeah, and so well, one thing that I quite like about the I don't know if this is written in the original books. I've only seen the TV series and the films, but when Sherlock Holmes sort of doesn't know really fundamental things about science. Because I think it's a really good demonstration that people who are experts in something don't just know everything about everything, which is so commonly, like, one thing, I love the Marvel films, but one thing that I don't like about the Marvel films is the way they represent intelligence. Because they'll have someone who's like a really smart mechanic, and then they'll just automatically know all this other stuff. And it's like, well, no, Sherlock Holmes didn't even know that the sun went round the earth. And his reasoning was, well, I don't need to. It's not important for what I want to do. But I think that's a much better representation of how it works, really.
Yeah. Whereas Tony Stark just has his nanobots do everything for him.
Yeah.
or they kind of just use Doctor Strange's magic to explain everything, or Wakandan vibranium.
Yeah, they've always got another explanation out of nowhere.
They're all cop outs, aren't they?
So. But I keep loving their content, so I keep consuming it nonetheless. yeah, no, really cool. This week I was going to talk about, well, what I initially wanted to do. I did a bit of research for this one. I wanted to say something along the lines of, there's as much copper in an octopus as there is in your iPhone, something along those lines. But I tried to research how much copper there was in an octopus, and the only thing I could get is off like a recipe website saying like how much copper there is in like an 85 gram octopus steak. And I thought that's probably not a very good actual representation of the real
octopus steak. Wow.
Well, you can get their little tentacles. They can be grilled. Very common in like Spanish food. But anyway, the reason why I was looking into that is because octopus's blood is blue-green. Mm. It's not red like ours. And that's because instead of hemoglobin, they have hemocyanin. And that is copper rather than iron. So, you know, when iron oxidizes, it sort of goes orangey. When copper oxidizes, it goes sort of bluey-greeny. The Statue of Liberty is a really good example. And so I was looking into, you know, why is this better? And actually, hemocyanin is four times worse at transporting oxygen than hemoglobin is. So hemoglobin's really good. Hemocyanin, not so good. But the problem is, at really cold temperatures, hemoglobin just doesn't work anymore. And so these octopuses, which are right at the bottom of the sea, they're not like birds. They can't travel very far very quickly because they just sort of crawl around. So they're stuck there. They can't move. So they've got to deal with it, basically. But what's also interesting is scorpions have sort of blue-greeny blood as well, because they have hemocyanin as well. Because in very hot temperatures, hemoglobin doesn't work that well anymore. So, you know, you see all these films, these sort of sci-fi films where you kill an alien and outspurts this sort of green sludge. But actually, there's loads of animals, mostly invertebrates, but still a lot of animals, and mostly at the bottom of the ocean or in the desert, that do bleed blue-green. Hemoglobin is, so it's the second most common oxygen transporter, but there's even a fish called the oscillated ice fish that its blood is colorless. It's completely clear because it doesn't need a transporting mechanism at all, because apparently it's so cold where it swims that oxygen just transports really naturally anyway. I didn't spend too much time going into the specifics of that, but it just
dissolves in the blood itself.
Yeah. And they actually, so these fish don't have scales, and the oxygen just dissolves through the skin and then sort of moves. They still have blood. The oxygen sort of gets into the bloodstream as transported around, but it doesn't need a carrier basically. So there's lots of different animals with different colored blood, which is quite cool, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Maybe the sci-fi writers were onto something then with the blue smudges.
Maybe. You know, octopuses are pretty strange things. They're pretty alien. But, you know, it's good that sci-fi writers are basing their work in scientific fact. That's always important.
Yeah, absolutely.
It raises my hopes for, you know, lightsabers to exist at some point. So that's good.
Yeah, what would it take to build a...
Oh, I don't know. I think that could be a topic as well. How to build your own lightsaber.
Well, what's interesting about octopuses, which I find quite strange, is they're actually colorblind because they only have one photoreceptor.
Okay, I didn't know that.
So I'm always confused as to how they manage to camouflage themselves so well in various colors and shapes. Well, I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Yeah. So. No, they're very intelligent creatures. And I think I've got a book about octopuses that I'm working through slowly, which is the basis of my octopus knowledge. But I think they're relatively not that well understood.
They were given They were given some, I think, protected sentient life status, I think, very recently.
Yeah, and lobsters as well. So that's in the UK. So you know how traditionally lobsters would sort of be boiled alive in a pot? That's now illegal in the UK, which I imagine the lobsters are very happy about.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think the alternative is the chefs just stab a knife through their head instead, which I don't know if that's much better.
It gets you going quickly, aren't
you? Quickly, which is good. Yeah, cool.
We'll wrap it up then. Thanks very much.
I'll see you next week. We're doing well here.
Yeah, we're doing well.
All right, take care, Ronan.
Bye.
See you.